Blog Talk Radio.
The wonderful Ken Burns' latest documentary. I think he's done over 25, and this one on the Roosevelts. And of course, he had the first section was on President Theodore Roosevelt. A lot of things were not known or not widely known about Teddy Roosevelt. He had probably his administration or his family had more different types of animals while Teddy was in the White House. And one of the funniest anecdotes, which I wrote in my book, Political Animals, which is being revised, by the way. The French ambassador was visiting the White House, and Teddy Roosevelt had a pit bull, and the pit bull either bit the French ambassador in the butt or chased him up a tree, and Teddy thought that was just bully in more ways than one. They've had raccoons and all types of animals. Of course, probably the most famous animal anecdote of American presidency was President Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Fella, the Scotty. But Roosevelt Franklin had a, when he was governor of New York, he had a German, it was a German Shepherd, which belonged to one of the Roosevelt children, or to the family, and reportedly bit the senator from Arkansas, was a woman, so the dog was given to the New York State Police. And of course, Kennedy had Macaroni, the horse, for his daughter, and LBJ had the beagles, which he pulled their ears, and everybody who was an animal welfare advocate jumped on LBJ for that. And of course, Clinton had Sox, and of course, Bush had these Springer Spaniels, I think. But those are just a few of the anecdotes that were not covered in the Ken Burns series. It's a series that everybody should see. Now, I don't know if this is going to be covered. We're just getting this being broadcast out here on the West Coast this week. But what is relevant in the presidency of these at least FDR, or president since Wilson, all of them, Wilson, FDR, Truman, Kennedy, Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy, LBJ, and now we have Obama saying, in effect, there will be no boots on the ground. But it started with Woodrow Wilson, who ran on a campaign. He kept us out of war. In other words, American soldiers are not going to fight the war in Europe, fight Germany, and the Americans were not going to be on the side of the British and the French and Russia. Then we had FDR, who made a statement, your sons will not fight in a foreign war, and we know what happened. Then we have, this is not well known, Harry Truman sent, I think it was 100 military advisors to help the French when it was French Indochina. Then we had Eisenhower, who sent some more American military advisors. Then Kennedy upped the ante to 400 approximately. Then LBJ inherited that war, and it ended up with over a half a million American soldiers in Vietnam. And now we have Mr. O telling us we are not going to, there's not going to be boots on the ground. You cannot say never, never say never, as James Bond would say in his various series, or Ian Fleming, who was a U.S. British naval Royal Navy commander in intelligence. So that statement, no boots on the ground, has no historical credibility, because we don't know what's going to happen, especially when we start getting involved in these foreign wars and foreign conflicts. Now, more on the White House and relationships. Now, Eleanor Roosevelt was a fifth cousin of Franklin, and increasingly their marriage was one of political convenience. The children were growing up. Franklin was known to be devious, and also a lot of people didn't know this until even after his death, that he had a long, ongoing relationship with Lucy Mercer, who was from a prominent Maryland family. She was Catholic. She was a secretary. And apparently when FDR was Undersecretary of the Navy in World War I, Eleanor discovered a whole packet of letters between Franklin and Lucy Mercer. And, of course, Eleanor was increasingly falling away from FDR, and she had the children. She wanted to assert herself in her life, and she had got a former newspaper woman, Lorena Hitchcock, who came to work for her. And apparently, this is the first known case of a lesbian relationship in the White House. They're not coming out in Ken Burns' statement and saying so much, but it is. There's some historical substance to this statement that there was some kind of a relationship, and it's believed to have been a lesbian relationship. And of course, we're now seeing more and more lesbians in politics. Some of them are still in the closet. There is such a thing as a lesbian who's in the closet, but is for appearances' sakes, is married to a male, and man is called a merkin. That's a word used for the that type of relationship. When a man is in the closet and a woman is married to a woman for public appearances, the woman is called a beard. So these things go on, and we may see more of this. Certainly, it's come out on the web. Many people who do web pages and blogs have come out and pointed to Hillary and the relationship with Huma. Now, today, let's go to the birthdays. Today, among the birthdays is Louis Kossuth. Now, Kossuth was in the 19th century, early 19th century, he was a Hungarian freedom fighter. Hungary was under the domination of Austria, was known as the dual empire and the dual monarchy. And when the Austrian emperor was crowned, he was crowned first in Vienna, then he had to go to Budapest and be crowned there. And there's a famous piece of music, I think by Franz Liszt, called Kossuth, or by Bartok, who was Hungarian. Famous English professor, Bergen Evans, born on this day. We have Lurline Wallace, who was the wife of George Wallace. She ran for governor when George's term was up, and I think she died of breast cancer. We have Mike Royko, who I was acquainted with in Chicago. at the Billy Goat Bar, which is underneath Wacker Drive and near the Chicago Tribune. The last time I talked to Royko was in 1984 at the Democratic National Convention, which was held here in San Francisco. I asked him a question, and he kind of blew me off. He was a little peeved. If you remember that man from Uncle, the blonde Scottish actor David McCallum, was also in The Great Escape. It's his birthday. And, of course, those of us from the 60s who remember the Mamas and the Papas, well, Big Mama Cass Elliot was born on this day. Among the deaths, the assassination of President James Garfield, he was one of part of the Ohio presidents, which were Harrison, Cleveland, Garfield. Garfield was assassinated by, and Hayes, excuse me, also. Garfield was assassinated by I think it was Charles Gutcheau, deranged office seeker. And I think Chester Arthur became president. He was vice president. And Chester Arthur came out of the New York Republican politics, and he was the head of the customs office of the Port of New York, and, of course, that was a great source of graft. And, of course, the only thing you remember about Chester Arthur, well, two things. He was supposed to have been born in Quebec, Canada, but he claimed to be born in Vermont. And also, this term is not used today, Arthurian, which Chester Arthur had this very unique beard. And he only served one term, as I recall. Also on this day, we have George Washington's farewell address. He refused to run for a third term. And, of course, Teddy Roosevelt tried, in a different sense, on running on the Bull Moose Party. And, of course, FDR surprised everyone in 1940. He decided, up to that time, no president had dared come out and say, I want a third term and I'm going to run for it. But FDR did, and he also ran for a fourth term, but he died in office, and Harry Truman succeeded him. Also on this day in 1849, believe it or not, Oakland, California, the first commercial laundry was set up. I don't know if it was run by the Chinese. Also on this day in 1873, talking about financial manipulation in the stock market, there was a guy named Jay Gould. It was called Black Friday. Of course, we had Black Thursday when the stock market crashed in 1929. Of course, it was a lot of part of the reason was real estate speculation, buying stocks on margin, and all kinds of financial manipulation. And interestingly, getting back to FDR, when he came into office, he and the Democrats in Congress passed the Glass-Steagall Act, which banned banks from engaging in some of these predatory practices, which were also very risky. Clinton administration repealed Glass-Steagall, so we're back through banks doing all kinds of financial transactions, which got them into trouble back in the early part of the century. Also on this day, Bruno Hauptmann, the German immigrant who was accused and arrested in the case of the kidnapping and death of Charles Lindbergh's baby. Hauptmann, some people say he was innocent. I don't know. Anyway, he was convicted in a fast trial, and he was executed. Also, on this day, in 1940, the Nazis ruled or ordered that Gentile women were not to work, were forbidden from work in the homes of Jewish women or Jewish houses. 1945, Lord Haha was the propagandist, was an Englishman who went to Germany and broadcast all kinds of Nazi propaganda. At the end of the war, he was apprehended, he was brought to England, tried, and he was hanged. We also had a woman, American, who also broadcast for the Nazis. There's another case of Rose Diacchino, who I knew later on. After she got out of prison, she did broadcast for the Japanese, but she was falsely accused of broadcasting propaganda. She was one of 20 American women and a couple of an Australian and an American male military who were broadcasting for the Japanese. They had been captured by the Japanese. And Walter Winchell was one of those responsible for railroading Rose Diacchino. Also known as Tokyo Rose. She was an American citizen who was caught in Japan beginning after Pearl Harbor And the Japanese secret police called the Kempeitai, which very few people know about the Kempeitai. They were the Japanese version of the Gestapo and the Russian version of Cheka and KVD. That anyway, these women were told, if you don't broadcast, we're going to either execute you or send you to a Japanese concentration camp. So what she did was she broadcast music, and she never told in all the broadcasts that she did, she never asked or exhorted the American military who were fighting in the Pacific to lay down their arms and come over and surrender to the Japanese. She did broadcast music, though. And she was illegally tried here in San Francisco, where there was a lot of anti-Japanese feeling. And she was tried in the Ninth Circuit, one of three infamous cases. And she was sentenced, she got a $10,000 fine and was sentenced to, I think, 5 years in federal women's prison. And on this day in 1959, George Christopher, the mayor of San Francisco, a friend of President Eisenhower, in 1959, Nikita Khrushchev came to visit the United States, and he was a bore at the UN. He pounded his shoe on the desk. Then he went to Iowa. He was insulted, so he said, by refugees, DPs from Europe, and people who had escaped the Soviet Union and the Iron Curtain. Then Khrushchev went to California. He wanted to go to visit and see Disneyland, but Walt Disney said no, and the excuse was, or the reason was, that he couldn't provide security. So Khrushchev was insulted, and he was going to break off the tour. And Eisenhower called George Christopher and says, can you invite Khrushchev to San Francisco and show him, you know, try to mend the fences? So this is the interview that I did with George Christopher before he died, one of several.
And gratitude, yeah.
The bileless weed.
Yeah.
Can we get to the lighter subject? Back to Mrs. Khrushchev. Do you remember the episode when they came here and she wouldn't get off the train? Just a little anecdotal thing.
Well, she had been, she was a sensitive lady. She was a fine lady, too. She wasn't the tough person that Nikita was. And he was quite a character, I must say. I enjoyed being with him for 2 weeks in the Kremlin. Because
that's when you did missions for Eisenhower?
What?
When you did diplomatic missions for Eisenhower?
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, I had been... I did quite a few like that, but... anyway, he... his wife had been insulted by a writer for one of the newspapers, I think the New York Times. Said that she didn't perform like a first lady of the USSR, but she wore black drab stockings, and her dress was too plain and not sufficiently glamorous. You know? So the poor lady didn't know what to make of it. So that morning when they were coming up from Los Angeles, they came up by train, as you know. And I had built a special platform out by the SP Depot to receive him. And Henry Cabot Lodge, who was escorting Khrushchev around the country at that time, said, now, he says, Mayor, you better be careful, because Khrushchev is going to find some excuse and leave and go back and then blast the United States for being inhospitable. So I was quite frank with Henry Cabot Lodge, who was a fine gentleman. I said, well, look, Ambassador, I call him Ambassador, because at that time he was Ambassador to the United Nations. I said, if he leaves, why doesn't he leave from Los Angeles? I don't want him to leave from San Francisco. You know, he said, we're on our way. He phoned me right from the train. We'll be there about 11 o'clock, he said. 10:30, 11 o'clock. Fine. So I called my florist immediately. I got him out of bed. I said, I'm going to go down to the store and get four dozen beautiful red roses and have them ready for me. So, in the meantime, I had called all the police back. No policeman had a day off. Some in plain clothes, most of them in uniform. And so here I am waiting now with my wife, and she had the roses. And Henry Cabot Lodge said, if you'll do all the, let me do all the talking, he said, because every place, all these mayors, wherever we go, they always say something and we get into trouble. And I said, well, no. I said, Ambassador, I don't think I want to do that. He says, well, why not? I said, well, to be frank with you, I said, so far you're not doing too well. So I said, what you better do is let me do the talking in my own stupid way. I said, and then if he leaves, it's my fault, because if he leaves and it's your fault, I'll still have to take the blame. But I can't say it's not my fault. It's Henry Cabot Lodge's fault. Well, he says, you got a point there. So Khrushchev came out of the train with Henry Cabot Lodge. I greeted him. Well, I tried to greet him, but I put my hand out just this far to see if he would reach for it, but he didn't do it. He didn't do it. He was still mad, seething mad. Oh, my God, he was absolutely mad. But Mrs. Khrushchev didn't come out. She was still in the train. So I kind of killed a little time, try to be a little, with a little levity, a little casualness, but I wasn't getting very far. So finally I decided I'd have to take a high risk, because if he was going to leave, I might as well get it over with. So I said to him, Mr. Chairman, I said, if you'd like to be called Mr. Chairman, I've determined that. I said, can you tell me, please, where the big boss is? Oh, my God. Poor Henry Cabot Lodge almost went through the floor. He almost dropped dead. That was the end of it, you know. So Khrushchev himself got a little excited. He said, what do you mean? I said, just between you and me, I said, I want you to know that everybody in San Francisco thinks I'm the big boss. He says, I'm not. I said, you know who the big boss is? He said, who? I said, see that lady over there with the big bunch of red roses? She's the big boss. I said, everybody in the Soviet Union thinks you're the big boss. But the big boss really is still in the train, and we're not going to leave here until she comes out. Well, by golly, that broke the ice, you know. He looked at me. All of a sudden, he had a big grin. He put his hand out. We shook hands. He says, you're all right. He says, you're different. Yeah. And poor Henry Cabot Lodge was appeased. You know, he was. So she came out. Then he went in and got her, brought her out. I had an extra car for her and my wife and brought her. But the one thing that really helped, because I was the only mayor that he invited to be his guest in Russia. But you know how they work it. They don't issue the invitation and say, first they ask you through some ambassador, if you are invited, would you accept? They can't afford to have a rejection, you see. And then if you say yes, well, then they issue the invitation. Well, they asked me the question. I said, certainly I'd accept. I said, as a result, all the San Francisco press came along with me. They paid their way, but the papers paid their way. So they asked me, and I went. But the thing that really made me, put me in a better position, was when we were at the Mark Hopkins Hotel. That's where we had a special suite for them up there. And that morning, I put a telephone call in to Russia to see how their daughter was doing. She was going to have a baby. She was pregnant. And in those days, you couldn't get a telephone call in 10 minutes like we do now. You had to wait 3 or 4 or 5 hours. So as a result, I put the call in about 11 o'clock that morning. Found out the lady had been given, the baby had arrived, 7 pounds of this and that and all that. And I broke the news to Mrs. Khrushchev. And she cried my shoulder, you know. And she said, thank you. Спасибо.
Speak Russian, too.
Yeah. And when the press asked me later what the story was about, I said, you have to bear in mind that grandmothers are the same all over the world. I don't care what color they are, black, white, pink, blue, yellow. Grandmothers are grandmothers. And all I did was to accord her the courtesy of apprising her that her daughter had given birth. I said, even a lion cub will attack you and tear you to pieces if you try to touch one of its cubs, you see? Even a lioness, I said, would do that. So I think she appreciated it, and as a result, I was invited, and they spent 2 weeks with them. And I was in his private plane, and the press, I always insisted that the press be accorded the privilege, too. I didn't want to
slight them. Yeah.
I didn't want to slight them, but I just didn't want them to think I was hiding something, too. So they had every benefit of going where I was going. And only one time, well, a couple of times, I wanted to go to church, and young Gromyko was assigned as my personal guide.
And he was the foreign minister.
What?
He was the foreign minister at the time, Gromyko?
No, his son.
Oh.
His son, yeah. His son was my guide, and he says, well, I don't go to church. That's okay. He says, I'll take a cab, and I'll go there myself. Oh, he said, no, the boss told me to be with you. So we went to church, and they had a big ceremony there. It was a
Russian Orthodox.
Yeah. I was surprised to see all these churches created into museums, changed. And when we went down to Tbilisi, this was an interesting thing. It gave us a big reception there. But on the way back, we ran into some turmoil, bad weather. And this was about 1 o'clock or 12 o'clock midnight. The plates were coming out of the shelves in the plane. The plane was shaking up. So finally, and a heavy rain, a tremendous rain. So finally, about 2 o'clock, we landed in some place. We didn't know where we were. So, and there were four cars out there when we landed. And I said to Gromyko, where are we? He said, I don't know. I said, well, okay, we'll take care of that later. And the mayor was there. The mayor of the town was there. So we all got out in big umbrellas and got into the cars. They brought me to the mayor's house where we slept. And they brought the press down to the hotel, not too far away, to spend the night, because the next morning at 7 o'clock we had to move on. So when I arrived at the mayor's house, I said to Gromyko, again, where are we? He says, I don't know. So I said, well, now we're going to have a little trouble. See? So I sat down with a cup of chocolate. And so I said, Anatoly, will you please sit down a minute? He said, sure. I said, like, a couple of times you told me you don't know where we are. I said, I think you do. You know? He says, how do you know that? I says, I'll tell you how I know it. because we arrived here at 2 o'clock in the morning, rainy, and the mayor happened to be out there with just a number of cars that we needed. That's just what we needed, 4 cars for the press and for me. And I said, I want you to know I'm the mayor of a set city too. And I don't go out to the airport and wait out there all night in case somebody comes in at 2 o'clock in the morning to give them a ride into town. I said, now, you know, you better treat me with as having some intelligence. So he kind of grinned. He says, well, yeah, he says, we're in Carshi. I said, well, I don't know anything about Carshi, but we'll find out. And I found out on the way out to the plane that morning, we passed a valley. There must have been 800 fighter planes down there. There must have been, just the place was conglomerated. It was just filled with small fighter planes. And I said, I don't blame you. I said, but don't, you know, you can always get caught in a lie.
A lot of politicians do.
Well, yes, but I mean, he was trying to defend his, protect his country, but I got incensed because he was trying to delude me, too.
You had a diplomatic mission that I think involved De Gaulle or Konrad Adenauer.
Well, we'll get to that another day. Anyway, we will get into this California politician, Stephen Bradford, who, if you come to San Francisco, you're going to have to be especially careful about driving and bicyclists who have special rights, according to this guy Bradford, who's from Gardena, California. There's a lot of questions about this guy, black politician from one of the most corrupt cities in California. And, of course, the bicycle agenda, I brought this up before, during World War II, when the Nazis occupied Western Europe, they banned as much as they could people from driving cars and trucks, and they banned Jews from any type of locomotion, cars, trucks, even riding on public transport. And the Nazis permitted people to ride bicycles, and that's how they controlled the movement of people in the occupied Europe. And there are people who think this is part of a totalitarian agenda that some people have to impose on Americans. So we shall see what we shall see. Anyway, I apologize. I was ill Wednesday. I had been injured, and I'm still recovering, but recovered enough to do the show. We should be back Monday and maybe Wednesday of next week. So we'll end with our usual politics and poker.
What do you say, Ben? Want a hand?
Go ahead. I got too much on my mind to play poker.
King bet.
Cost you five. Tony, up to you.
Hey, Tony, what are you
going to
do?
I'm in.
So am I.
Likewise.
Me too.
Gentlemen, here we are, and one thing is clear. We gotta pick a candidate for Congress this year.
Big ace.
Ace bet.
You'll pay through the nose.
Okay, where's the time?
I'm in.
So am I.
Wise.
Here goes.
Possible straight. Possible flush. Nothing.
Gentlemen, how about some names we can use? Some qualified Republican who's willing to lose.
How's about we should make Jack Riley the guy?
Which Riley are you thinking of, Jack B or Jack Y?
I say neither one. I never even met him.
I say when you got a pair of Jack, better.
Politics or poker, which is more important?
Paraphrase.
Bet 'em.
Little trade's good as gold.
I'll say.
Raise your mind.
I'll fold. I'll raise your back.
I think you're bluffing.
Put your money where your mouth is.
Okay, I'm in.
Gentlemen, knock it off and let's get this done.
Try Michael Fanyushinkovic. I'm certain he'd run.
Mike is out. I'm afraid he just wouldn't sell. Nobody likes a candidate whose name they can't spell.
How about Dave Zimmerman?
Davey's too bright.
What about Walt Gustafson?
Walt died last night.
How about Frank Monahan?
What about George Gale?
Frank ain't a citizen and George is in jail.
We could run Al Wallenstein.
He's only 23.
What about Ed Peterson?
You idiot! That's me!
Politics and poker! Politics and poker! Play for a pot that's mediocre! Politics and poker! Running neck and neck! If politics seems more predictable, that's because usually you can stack the deck!
Peter Paul Barzola. We should be back Monday at 3:30 Pacific Standard Time. Stay safe. It's also probably be the first day of fall. Good night.